Welcome back to the Bible in Context.
The context is king, and the original author's intent drives our interpretation. Yeah. I sound a little weird today.
Good job, Nate. That was good. So he's kind of mush mouth today, just by the way.
Yeah, I did not think today through very well, and just got out of the dentist, and my mouth is completely numb. So you can't see it, but I'm probably drilling all over myself, and certain words I'm sure are going to come out very funny. So I might speak a little slower than I typically do.
Well, he's being a champ in trying this out. So, he went to the dentist, didn't think he was going to get his mouth numb. Also today, I asked him to do some extra talking on a certain topic and try to share the load because we're trying to tackle a new topic. And today is the day he got his mouth numbed. So
good times.
Good times. All right. So today we're going to be covering the topic of who is Israel? Who is true Israel? What is their relationship to the church? And this is kind of a deviation from what we've been doing already with the canon series. We're kind of breaking in here for a minute. And the reason that we're doing this is just because there's been a lot of, obviously, political tension in the past couple of years with Israel, more so than usual. And in the past week or so, it's really risen. And so we thought it would just be beneficial. And especially since, as a church, we're in a Revelation series right now. So the topic of Israel is coming up a lot. We just want to do an episode on who is Israel, what are the different views, and what is a proper biblical understanding of Israel and the church. And this is a view that is very contested, but it's also something that is very secondary. And so there are a lot of good brothers and sisters on both sides here. And so we want to emphasize at the beginning that even though this is a heated debate that people sometimes raise to the level of a top tier issue, it is not. And so we can disagree, but we still think it has a lot of implications for how we think of ourselves as Christians and how we see our national obligations, political obligations a lot of times. So
yeah, and how we understand the end times too.
Right, and how we understand the end times, exactly. So what are the main views that surround this topic and maybe some major players?
Yeah, so there's three general views in Christianity when it comes to the relationship between the church and Israel. And so the first view is probably the most popular one, that the church is distinct from Israel. And so this comes from dispensationalism. And this has become, at least in our current day, the most popular view that, and there's different.
Well, and when you say distinct, you mean that Israel is also their own covenantal entity still with a relationship to God, and the church is a separate. It's almost like there's two kingdom of gods in a way.
Yeah. And so the promises of the Old Testament that were for Israel, they would say, are for the ethnic Israel, and that the church has its own set of promises. Now, there are some progressive dispensationalists that would argue that some of the promises from the Old Testament are being fulfilled with the church, but classic dispensationalists really have a distinct view between the two. Now, on the opposite end of the spectrum, there are some who believe that the church replaces Israel completely. And that all the promises of the Old Testament that were geared towards Israel are now fully being fulfilled through or in the church. And I'll talk about the history of each of these here in a minute. But the third view, which is held by a lot of covenant theology, is the church is grafted into Israel. So talk about the history of dispensationalism, because it's newer than the other views. It's only been around for a couple hundred years. Well, they might argue that it goes back all the way to
back to Jesus.
But it became popular fairly recently. And so back in the 19th century in England, and even maybe a century before then, they began. There's a book by William C. Watson called Dispensationalism Before Darby. And so he argues that there was a strong futuristic hope for ethnic national Israel that existed among English theologians in the 17th and the 18th century. But really, the father of dispensationalism is John Darby. He was part of the Plymouth Brethren here in the United States, and they had some revivals, and they influenced some other pretty popular revivalists like Billy Sunday and D.L. Moody. And so it's through these revivals that it really began to take off. And then The Schofield Study Bible in 1909 is where it really became popular. Also, there were seminaries like Dallas Theological Seminary, which started in 1924, that really took dispensationalism and taught it very in-depth. But then Hal Lindsey and the late great Planet Earth and his book, which became insanely popular, really made dispensationalism popular on a popular level.
Yeah, I mean, kind of like the Left Behind series.
Yeah, the Left Behind series then followed Hal Lindsey. They were very influenced by Hal Lindsey, so Tim LaHaye and Jerry B. Jenkins. And I can remember when I was in college and just out of college, where that book was really popular, or that series of books was really popular in the like Kirk Cameron and the movies.
Oh, yeah.
And I can remember having discussions about if the rapture happens, I mean, half of Chick-fil-A is going to be gone.
Well, that's helpful, like looking at the history a little bit, because I didn't know much of the history of it. I just know kind of the current state, I guess. And it's when you think about a doctrine that has not really been talked about until like the past couple hundred years, it throws a little bit of like, maybe we should think about this a little bit more critically, because this isn't something that they were talking about among like Augustine and Tertullian and Origen. Like, these are not very old, ancient ideas.
Right.
It's something that someone thought of pretty recently.
Well, and on top of that, you've got a bunch of celebrity Christians that are dispensationalists. Like, so, I mean, mm-hmm. John MacArthur, Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell, John Hagee, and then some older ones too, like W.A. Criswell, Bill Bright, the founder of Campus Crusade, James Dobson, Adrian Rogers, Warren Wiersbe, Dr. David Jeremiah, Billy Graham. Mm-hmm. And so,
a popular one is Chuck Missler that comes
Chuck
up
Missler,
a lot.
Yeah, Chuck Missler too.
Yeah.
And so, and several of those are more evangelistic TV preachers that we definitely wouldn't line up with,
right?
And a lot of their theology, but some of them are sound guys that I have a lot of respect for. So people that we have a lot of respect for hold to dispensationalism, and so want to just keep that in mind, that we approach this topic with a lot of humility. But there's also a lot of this has always been contested too. Well, and that's one of the unfortunate things I think that has happened, is because becomes so popular, there's a lot of people within the church that don't realize that this is actually pretty highly debated.
You get either, I feel like often you'll get either some scholars that are saying, hey, I think this might be something and it makes sense to me, and they present it. And then you get people who don't fully understand the subject running off on a popular level and like militarizing it and saying, this is the way it has to be. I see it. This smart guy over here said it, whatever. Yeah. But my smart guy said this. Or on the other hand, you get scholars who are saying like, I found the answer, and like very adamantly saying, this is the way it is. And all the other guys are wrong. And again, on a popular level, they raise it to this extent of like, if you don't understand this, you don't understand the gospel, that kind of stuff. Saying those honestly dumb comments that make people, again, just fight over these things and make them equate them with the gospel.
Right. Yeah, we have a really high, and even we were talking about the interview between Tucker Carlson and Ted Cruz, where some of these topics came up and it became a firestorm on social media. But I mean, their conversation was so hard to listen to because they're interrupting each other constantly. And so we've gotten to this place in society where we just have a really hard time having productive conversations when it comes to things that are debatable.
Well, I guess there is also the factor, too, that it is so practical in a sense with things that people care about, like, you know, should America go to war or not?
Right.
That it does make it a heated thing on a popular level.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I get that. I think it's helpful, though, to understand the history and the different views and the theology that comes behind it. But I think at the very beginning, we need to recognize this is a very hotly debated topic.
Yeah.
And I didn't even mention, like, so non-dispensationalists include guys like D.A. Carson, Tim Keller, John Piper, Alistair Beggs, Wayne Grudem, Tom Schreiner, Mark Dever, and really all the pastors before the 1800s, like Calvin, Luther.
Okay. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's, and also just as an aside here, we're not going to give you any political advice. That is outside of my realm. And I don't know if you feel confident giving.
I have no desire to weigh in on whether or not we should have bombed Iran outside of my pay grade.
We're just going to tell you what the Bible thinks about the nation of Israel and the church, and then you guys can go forward from there. But yeah, that's really interesting just to hear there are so many, especially respected theologians and pastors and scholars that are on and off of this whole dispensationalism boat.
Now, so, I will say the idea that the church replaces Israel, most scholars today have
abandoned that idea.
And that could go back all the way to, and I'm going to have a hard time saying his name, but to Tertullian. Thank you. Certain words are really hard for me to say right now. But and there's some evidence in the early Catholic Church that they held that kind of view, and they rejected that at the Second Vatican, primarily because, and scholars today recognize that that kind of theology perhaps played a role in creating this culture that led to the Holocaust. And so at the end of the day, though, we need to look at the Bible and see what does the Bible actually say.
Yeah. So what points do they use to support the idea that the church and Israel are separate entities that both have their own separate promises from God? They're separate peoples of God. How do they prop that idea up? So oftentimes they'll look at Peter's confession of Jesus being the Christ, and Jesus says, on this rock, I'll build my church. And so they're like, look, he is establishing the church as a new thing. In Acts 2, you see the church, it's this new thing that branches off of Israel rather than out of it. Well, they look at John the Baptist. There's no one greater than him, but he's still least in the kingdom of heaven. And so therefore, the kingdom of heaven is the church, and he is the greatest of the old age of Israel. So showing that the church is this, again, this new thing off the side. They also look at the Holy Spirit differentiating the ages between Israel and the church. They look at all the references to Christ's kingdom, to God's kingdom, as being different than the kingdom of Israel. It's, again, relating to the church rather than the nation of Israel. So now there's this new entity that does not fully negate the promises that were made to national Israel. It's like Jesus just came and he didn't continue. That's really what it does, kind of. He doesn't just continue the story of the Old Testament expectations. He begins a new story with the church while allowing the Old Testament story to just continue on forward. So they look at the promises in Genesis 12 of Abraham's children being a nation. In Genesis 15, they possess the land, and they see that land promise as an eternal covenant. Really, the battleground, which we're going to talk about this in depth in a little bit, is going to be, and this might split into two episodes, so you might have to come back to part two for this, but a lot of the battleground is Romans 9 through 11, and so we're going to take an in-depth look at that as well. So first of all, I just want to mention that you should probably go back and listen to our episodes on prophecy before you listen to this one, because I think that is going to be relevant for how we understand a lot of the promises from the Old Testament to Israel. Often whenever God is giving promises to Israel, things he's going to do with them, he is saying, based on this current state, if you remain faithful to me, I'm going to do this through you. I'm going to accomplish my purpose, you know, no matter what. If you guys are faithless, what's going to happen is I'm going to still accomplish that through another means. And so that is just something to realize going into this. In the Old Testament, God's promises and the things that are said through prophecy are not always looking at a crystal ball through looking into the future. Rather, they're saying what God's intentions are, and if Israel and Judah remain faithful in this current circumstance, he will accomplish that intention through them. If they are faithless, then he'll do it with the next generation. And so we see that time and time again. You know, Adam and Eve, they were supposed to be the ones to be fruitful, multiply, and subdue the earth and make everything the garden. And then it was Noah. He failed. And then it was Abraham, and he finally passed the test. But you just get this sense as you go through biblical prophecy, and especially when you look at how the New Testament interprets and uses that prophecy, you get this feel that God was not looking through a crystal ball and saying what he will do necessarily with Israel and Judah. Rather, at the time, Israel and Judah were the means by which God was going to accomplish his plans to redeem humanity. So I think that's an important thing to understand as we go through this, although we're not going to hit too terribly much on that particular topic.
Do you think it would be helpful for people to listen to our podcast on typology also?
That'd
seems like
too.
The dispensationalists would reject a lot of typology when it comes to.
Yeah, those episodes go hand in hand. I mean, prophecy and typology, because often typology is a prophetic tool. But yeah, seeing the repetition throughout throughout the Bible of God's promises, it also kind of shows you, as you see the repeated promises and the repeated elements, it kind of shows you what is essential and what is just circumstantial.
Could you argue that, I mean, Israel as a nation, what was a type? I mean, starting back with Abraham.
But... Well, I mean, you get back to Adam and Eve, and they are literally portrayed as, and again, go listen to some of our early Old Testament canon series episodes or read Adam as Israel. Adam is literally portrayed as Israel. Everything that happened to Israel in its history happened to Adam on a large scale.
Right.
And so you do have this idea that God is trying to work through Adam. Adam and Eve, they screwed up. I'm going to work with their sons, Cain and Abel. Well, Abel died. Cain failed. I'm going to use Seth's family instead. We get down to Noah, and his family fails. Okay, I'm going to try and use... Yeah, and then you get to the Tower of Babel, and everyone fails again. So I'm going to try and use Abraham. And then he goes down to Egypt, and he fails. And so God says, I'm going to give this guy another chance. And finally, he passes. And so you get this idea that it's like, it's not necessarily about the person or the tool that is being used to accomplish God's plans, but it's about his intentions being accomplished.
Right.
So, yeah, just something, I think, a good background to keep in mind. You also see some of the things dispensationalists will often use to contrast the church and Israel. The wedge that is often driven between the kingdom of heaven and Israel and the church, that's just not an idea that's in the text. You have to really read that in there. Every time that they say the kingdom of heaven, like, oh, that's the church, and it's definitely not Israel. Israel was supposed to be God's kingdom. That was where God was going to dwell and set up his throne in Jerusalem. So you can't really drive that wedge in there. So we'll tackle some more of these particular issues as we keep going. But I just want to mention here Jason Staples, and we've brought him up before, but I think he's really relevant right now. He has a couple of books that are worth reading detailing how Jews from the Second Temple period understood the nation of Israel. And then he has a second book that goes into how Paul is exactly in line with how Jews understood themselves in that era. So, and for those of you who don't know, the Second Temple period is basically from a little bit after Jesus, you know, 40 years or so back to a few hundred years before Jesus. So just that era. So the way that Second Temple Jews understood the nation of Israel, in the Second Temple period, you didn't have all of Israel because the northern tribes of Israel had been scattered and dispersed out to all the world. And then it was mainly the returning Judahites that came back after Persia. But they still understood Israel not as just Judea. They understood, which is the Jews, the Judahites mainly, they understood Israel to be the full 12-tribe covenantal people who were dispersed. This includes like the Samaritans, who they were not Jews, but they were Israelites. They were part of that larger camp that included both the northern and southern kingdom of Judah and Israel.
Now, I do think dispensationalists view ethnic Israel not just as those who there live over in Israel, but the dispersion.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
They would include the Jews here in America too.
Everyone who has Jewish blood. So yeah, the Jews of the Second Temple period, they understood Israel as not just the Jews who lived in Judea. They were mainly, again, named after the Judahites, but as the entire 12-tribe covenantal people of God who were somewhat in Judea, but also in Samaria, also dispersed over the entire ancient Mediterranean world, thanks to Assyria. So Second Temple Jews, they saw Israel as the 12 covenantal tribes of Israel. And what they also saw was those who were unfaithful to that covenant were no longer true Israel. That is a huge point that he shows and hits on, is the fact that throughout the writings of the Second Temple Jews, if there are Israelites who are no longer faithful to Yahweh, they are no longer considered Israelites. That's going to be really important for what we're talking about going ahead. So that is how they understood Israel. Now, why is that significant? In the Old Testament, you get all of these promises about Israel being restored and about all the 12 tribes coming back and reconstituting the 12 tribes of Israel once again, and Gentiles coming back and streaming with them. In some cases, they're bringing them back. And so that's kind of the setup that you have as you go into the New Testament period. Now, what Staples is going to argue more in depth, we won't get into all this right now. What we're going to do is just go through at a high level what he's arguing and then go into some verses that will display what we're saying. So first of all, he argues that the church, the assembly, which that word church, it's just the word ecclesia, which means assembly, which has a lot of baggage from the Old Testament. Remember, that is an Old Testament idea. This is not just a new church, a new form of something. This is rather the restored assembly of Israel. The church is not a separate entity from Israel, but a restored Israel in which the Gentiles are incorporated. And so it's not that Israel and the church are separate. Rather, it is Gentiles joining the true nation of Israel. That is what Paul pictures the ecclesia, the church, as. Paul notices that Gentiles are receiving the Spirit. Now, that was promised to Israel. That was not a promise to, you know, one day I'll come visit you and then I'm going to pour my Spirit out on the Gentiles and you Israelites don't get it. No, the promise is that I'm going to restore Israel and pour out my Spirit in the last days. You see that in Joel. And Paul notices that this Old Testament promise on Israel is happening to Gentiles. So that should speak pretty loudly. And so I want to walk through a few passages that illustrate this idea. And what we're going to see, I think, is that the new covenant that, you know, Jeremiah refers to is still with Israel. And Jeremiah says that covenant's coming to Israel. It's not coming to the Gentiles. And so this is not some sort of separate church and separate Israel. Rather, all those who are, all those Israelites who are faithful to Jesus are part of true Israel. All those Gentiles who are faithful to Jesus have joined Israel. All those Israelites who are unfaithful to Jesus have left Israel. Unfaithful Israelites are no longer Israel. Faithful Israelites are Israel, and faithful Gentiles have joined and become Israel. So this is not supersessionism. This is not
replacement theology.
Yeah, this is not replacement theology. This is not two separate kingdoms of God going on at the same time. This is incorporation of the Gentiles into the nation,
yeah,
and the excommunication of those who are unfaithful.
This is basic covenant theology approach to, that's how covenant theology would approach this, which goes back to the Reformation.
Gotcha. So that incorporation theology is what we're going to be looking at here, and that's what we're going to be highlighting a lot. So because of time, we're going to go ahead and wrap this one up, and then next episode, next week, we're going to be taking a look at some major verses that really display this. And I think as we look at those verses and look at the way that they deal with the Old Testament expectations, it really becomes clear that the way that Israel thought about itself is the same way Paul was thinking about Israel, and that the way that he saw the church was as a restored Israel with Gentiles incorporated and unfaithful Israelites cut off. All right, so we'll tackle those verses next time.